Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio.
Easy for you to say.
At least I knew it was a blue heron.
Yeah.
My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. Ta-da. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer, and they've got everything you want when it comes to John Deere. Go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard, and they've got a full inventory right now of mowers, Z-mowers, riding mowers, tractors, implements.
What's a Z-mower?
Z-mower, that's one of those mowers that you drive with levers instead of a steering wheel, and they zip around about twice the speed of a regular mower. They're a lot of fun.
Wow.
Yeah, need to go up. Yeah, go up and see them. You can even take a test drive. They'll flip you the keys, and you can drive it around a lot, see how you like it.
Mow the rocks.
Well, yeah, you probably won't be able to turn the mower on.
Turn the mower.
Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or you can catch them on the web at PapeMachinery.com.
Mm-hmm.
There you are.
There you go.
Yeah.
And, we're getting a thumbs up. Thumbs up from our friend
Liam. That was for me.
Liam in the booth.
Yeah.
He was giving you the mower thumbs up.
Yep. He was giving me the thumbs up.
Hey, and if you're having any issues with the website, our website, by the way, at wethepeopleradio.us, if you have any issues with the color or the ability to read the words or, you know, any of that stuff, because I had to switch it all around, would you email us? That'd make it really, really easy. There's a contact form right there on the page, or it's Erin, E-R-I-N, at wethepeopleradio.us.
Speaking of color, I'm not into the puce you have on the one page there, so.
No, I tried to make it tan, and it just won't do tan. And then when you do it on the phone, it's a different color.
Yeah.
It shows up a different color on the
phone.
Those
are mobile colors.
I got boined on that one.
Yeah.
So anyway, Robert and I are doing a matching effort on the archive site and the regular site. So there's stuff moving around. We're sorry about that. Try to keep it the same as much as we can. But if you have any problems, let us know. Or you see anything funky, let me know. So our guest today is William Walter Kay. I've been thinking we needed to get back to Canada to find out what was going on up there, but then he's talking about Australia, so but maybe we'll still find out what's going on up in Canada. He has earned an English degree in 1982. I think mine was 1985, so we were doing the same thing. But then he did what my dad wanted, and he went to law school, got his law degree in 1985. After practicing law, he went on to establish a small business and nonprofits, and he's written two books. The Green Swastika, Environmentalism in the Third Reich, and From Malthus to My Pristestone. I never get that word right. I don't know what it is. It's a big tongue twister. It's about population control. Let's cut to the chase. It's about population control. We did a really good show with him on population control, too, so if that's a topic that you're wondering about, you hear it a lot, and you think, oh, that's silly, they're not doing that, or you think they're totally doing that, and you'd like to actually have accurate info, scroll down through the shows on today's page. Today would be the 15th of... 15th? Yeah.
It's January
25th.
Yeah.
Or January 15th, 2023. And your computer's wrong. Go to the front page. And he's a producer, appeared in countless radio programs, posted hundreds of articles across dozens of websites, and he's a really outspoken critic of the catastrophic anthropogenic means caused by people, global warming hypothesis, and related policies. He's been doing that for like 35 years. But that was where we first got involved with him was his website was Environmentalism is Fascism, and it's like, oh, I think we like him. We might want to talk to him. And that's, how long ago did we do that? 2011. So we did that within the first year of the show, actually. And we've been chatting about things ever since. So, William, I know you sent me some other new stuff, but then you had the thing about the coal, and we could talk about whatever you want. You got a long list today.
Well, the Australia connection is because I do a regular show for TNT Radio in Brisbane now, and that is definitely coal country, like we don't even have in North America. USA has the largest coal reserves. Australia comes in third, but Australia only has, you know, probably about 8% of the population of the UK, so their coal is just the backbone of their economy. It's their number one export. Before the climate campaign, it was over 80% of their electricity came from coal. and they are facing the same coal phase-out that the USA is. So it is absolutely going to devastate their economy. So there's a lot of pushback there, even though they're suffering the same sort of political paralysis that the rest of us are. But increasingly, I'm just focusing, trying to get people to wrap their brain around the idea that this is actually economic warfare.
Mm-hmm.
That if you're talking about destroying America's coal industry and America's petroleum industry, you're basically taking out both the country's legs. And it is such a massive change to America's economy and America's culture that it is absurd to think that it's merely a byproduct or collateral damage because we're so damned concerned about the sea levels 100 years from now. That doesn't pass the laugh test. The objective of this exercise is taking out America's oil industry and coal industry. That's the aim. And the climate propaganda is simply to facilitate that aim. It is not what is motivating people.
Yeah, and we've seen that it's really, really helping them in Europe, specifically Germany, I guess, comes to mind, to have kind of screwed themselves.
Yeah, they're kind of realizing that maybe that was the wrong road to go down.
Well, this campaign is definitely being orchestrated out of Europe. There's always an effort to sort of blame China or blame other groups for it. But if you know the actual history, of the campaign, this is something that was developed slowly in Europe, really starting in the mid-1970s and really picking up traction in the mid-80s. And the EU views America as a major rival, even though we're sort of allies, we're sort of frenemies. There's been long-running rivalry between the two areas. And I tend to use the term Anglosphere because America, Australia, and Canada are more or less in the same boat. They're countries that possess vast hydrocarbon reserves. They've really got something to lose by the shutdowns and the phase-outs of the coal and oil industry. The EU is not in that position. Not a single EU country. There's 27 countries there. Not a single one is a top 40 oil producer. Not a single one is a top 40 possessor of petroleum reserves. It's an area that's almost unusually devoid of petroleum. And they're importing hundreds upon hundreds of billions of dollars worth of petroleum every year. And it is very much in the long-term survival of the European Union that they phase out petroleum through electromobility, through hydrogen, through biofuels, through renewable energy, what have you. This policy, this energy transition, it makes sense in Europe. It is sound in Europe because it's allowing them to emancipate themselves from a dependency on a commodity which they have none locally.
Mm-hmm.
It does not make any sense in Canada, America, or Australia. Here it is going to have a devastating effect. Here we're knocking out what is our primary competitive advantage, is the possession of these hydrocarbon reserves.
Germany is reopening their coal industry, aren't they?
They're having to. The whole Russian crisis is sort of throwing a spanner in the works. A lot of countries around Europe are having to fire up some of them. There's simply not enough natural gas. They don't want the lights to go out. They're having to do it. But by all accounts, this is temporary. Once they sort of hook up the natural gas, so they're getting more of it from North America and from the Arab world, once they've overcome the sudden break with Russia, they will return to plan A, and that is using natural gas to phase out coal and try to bring in this renewable natural gas thing. It's a big mistake to think that they are abandoning the energy transition. They are not. They have every intention of completely phasing out coal mining in Germany. Poland is supposed to phase out coal mining. They're the only EU country that really depends on it. And it's causing a major friction. I wouldn't be surprised if Poland ends up getting kicked out of the EU for refusing to phase out their coal industry.
Are they talking about doing it or not? I mean, do they realize
Poland?
That they can't do that? Poland? Yeah.
As a tribute to the peer pressure that these COP conventions can have, At one of recent COP convention, the Polish environment minister stood up and committed Poland to a 2030 coal phase-out. And then 1 hour later, after getting just screamed at by Polish prime ministers and presidents and everybody else, she takes the podium again to say that no, that she had misspoke and that the phase-out was for 2049.
Oh.
Which, and then Poland says that it's far enough in the future that they don't even want to think about it. That's what you do. But they say that ultimately they will transition to uranium, to nuclear power. But by the 2049 phase out, like, who cares? Who's thinking 25 years down the road? Nobody. But it's interesting that they're under that pressure, and that is not acceptable to the Germans and to the rest of the European Union, that Poland would remain a primarily coal-fired power country to 2049. That is not acceptable. So there's all kinds of other problems going on there. I wouldn't be surprised. Hate to make predictions, but if Poland just doesn't get the boot right out of it.
So is there any pressure being put on China and India for their use of coal? I mean, they're full steam
absolutely
ahead.
Absolutely none. Absolutely yeah. None. The way that it was structured in 1992, people with great political foresight, like George Bush Sr., signed this document called the United Nations Convention's Framework on Climate Change. And it has a list of countries at the end. They're called the Annex One countries. And they are the only countries who are undertaking economy-wide emission reductions targets and programs. And that is the European Union and the English-speaking countries and Norway and Turkey and Japan. Those are the only ones doing it. Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine, but we can draw red lines through them. They are no longer part of planet Earth. But it comes down to the European Union and Japan and the English-speaking world all agreeing to phase out coal and oil. But if you look at the European Union and Japan, you'll realize they don't have any domestic oil and coal industry. And this is not really going to cause them any damage. Rather, it's going to facilitate their efforts to achieve energy independence and energy security by emancipating their economies from dependence on fossil fuels. We are facilitating their agenda. And a child should see that if you knock out America's oil and coal industry, you know, that's what bombers do during the wars. You know, they attack each other's energy industries. We're seeing it right now in the Ukraine. That is what's happening. There is an economic warfare campaign being conducted against America, and it's destroying its coal industry. It's halfway through destroying its coal industry. And now it's really starting to set its sights on the oil industry, particularly the pipeline industry, stuff like that. But yeah, this is an economic warfare campaign.
Yeah, and in the meantime, you have China, which, you know, they're a developing nation, are exempt from all of this, and as they
not
move...
just China. There's 160 countries that are exempt.
Are they really?
Wow.
The only countries that are not exempt are the EU, Japan, and the English-speaking world. Of those countries, the only that have hydrocarbon industries worth sacrificing are the United States, Australia, and Canada. Britain does as well, but it was the first victim. It's completely yeah. shut down its coal industry, and it is suffering the consequences. It's good you're bringing up the China point, because there's always an effort to say that perhaps China's pulling the strings here. You hear that a lot in the climate skeptical community. I just don't think they have the capacity, the integration into the culture of America and into the political elites of America to, you know, pull off an operation like this. China does not. China is sort of isolated and marginalized. But if you look at the operations of NATO and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and the International Energy Agency and the United Nations Environment Program, they all involve top American officials, like ministerial conferences that are going on almost continuously. And at those conferences, they're almost always in Europe, and the Europeans almost always outnumber the Americans 25-1. And this is an ongoing process. But there is no way the People's Republic of China has anywhere near the sort of high-level treetop contact with the ministers and heads of state and heads of government that the European Union does. They have a lot more influence, magnitudes more influence on our government elites than the Chinese do.
Right, But they are taking full advantage of their ability.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, and grow their economy.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes. This is the timeline. You can find newspaper articles in the 1990s when the Europeans were convinced with the coming solar power revolution that all of those PV panels were going to be manufactured in Europe. Like going into the whole climate caper, Europe was of the view that all of this renewable energy stuff was going to be manufactured domestically. And then I remember seeing an article around the year 2010, and by that time China had 50% of the PV market were being manufactured in China. And now you're seeing numbers like 97%, 98%.
Yeah. Oops.
The Chinese they have their own branch plants now. The Chinese companies are putting factories into Vietnam and other places where they're getting even cheaper labor. Couple of points there.
Hold that thought. Let's not chop it in half. We'll take a quick break, come back with our guest, William Altercay. He is coming to us from Canada, and we're going to talk about, the energy stuff today. How about that? So here's a little salute to regular people.
Homemade sandwich, a half a jug of tea. Average Joe, average pay. Same old end, the same old day. But there's nothing wrong with a hard hat and a hammer. Kind of glue that sticks this world together. Hands of steel and cradle of the promised land. God bless the working man.
Be ashamed of the car I drive. I'm just glad to be here, happy to feel that. It don't matter if you're by my side. I'm satisfied. Well, it's all.
Long way to get to the last line. It's a snappy tune. I tell you, it does feel like we're going to the end of the line, though. There's something eerie about that. Go back to your two points there before we so rudely cut you off.
That's okay. I'm just trying. Oh yeah, 2 points about the fact that China and countries in that vicinity have completely taken over the PV manufacturing market. One, excellent article showing that China, those manufacturing facilities are powered by coal-fired power plants. They're paying 4 cents a kilowatt hour. You couldn't manufacture solar panels using solar power electricity. They would be so expensive no one would be able to afford them. And the same goes for the labor costs. Like this fantasy that the Europeans were having, they were going to be the workshop of the world for solar panels in the 90s. That was, could you imagine union labor and renewable energy for electricity? No, nobody could afford solar
panels. Nobody could afford them.
It's only
right.
With the super cheap labor and the super coal-fired electricity.
Were they ever even, like, on the field? Were they ever players? Or did it just blow right by him? I wasn't paying attention to that in the
90s. I remember reading it was from the 90s. It was profiling this rising German business star, and he was sort of the solar king of Germany, and he had all these PV manufacturing facilities in Germany. But I think that he's either bankrupt or he's moved the whole operation to the Orient, most likely.
Hmm.
No, they got totally whacked out of that market, and the same thing is now happening to them in the wind turbine market. You know, the Chinese, it's taken this long. All of that R&D that the Germans and the Danes, like the billions upon billions of dollars of R&D, they keep pouring into wind turbines. The Chinese are just appropriating that for free. And they are now squeezing out the Germans from a lot of these international offshore deals. Like, once again, the Germans and the Danes thought that this is another industry that they would dominate, not just domestically, but as the developing world converts to wind power, they would be getting the contracts for the turbines. And now they're losing that industry as well to China. But this was an unintended consequence. This is something that is happening now for a program that was adopted by European governments almost 50 years ago, like 48 years ago. And they had no idea where it was going to go. A lot of the technology, these giant coastal offshore wind turbines, no one had any vision that these things would exist. Same goes with electric vehicles. They when they first launched on the petroleum phase out in Europe in 1974, they thought the future was the hydrogen car, the solar cell. They still believed in that, and biofuels and things like that. They didn't have that much space in the electric vehicle, and it really wasn't until the late 80s, early 90s, which is like 15 years later, that they started to realize the potential of wind turbines. This program, this is now its 48th, 49th anniversary of this program.
Yeah, and here we are. We're now using this technology to our deficit. I mean, it doesn't.
Let's
pay
burn
for
everything
itself.
Down and use something magical.
Yeah, it just
we're all going to ride unicorns.
Feasible.
Yeah,
I wrote a pocket or article called "Aussies Go 100% Coal," and just to visualize. See, the real tragedy is people are not researching just how advanced modern steam turbine technology is, like how advanced these modern nuclear power plants and coal-fired power plants can get. It isn't, though, that's not static technology either. General Electric now produces a 1900 megawatt steam turbine.
Wow.
Your standard sort of wind turbine on land is 1 or 2 megawatts. This thing will produce 1900 times that.
Wow.
GE's largest offshore turbine, wind turbine, has 10 times the steel that their 1,900 megawatt turbine has in it. I mean, there's far more efficient turbines and electrical advancements going on in the nuclear industry and in the coal industry, and they're happening around the world. Places like China and Vietnam are building a lot of coal-fired power plants. So is South Korea. South Korea's got a power station now that produces over 6,000 megawatts. You would literally have to have, you know, probably 40,000 turbines to equal the amount of electricity they can produce. And the turbines are built by Toshiba's, and they're all over 1,000 megawatts. That's the future. This is going on now, but there's great advances being made in sort of creating power stations where you have very long arrays of turbines and making those turbines a lot larger. And they will be producing electricity so much more cheaply and reliably than this renewable bunk.
What do you,
and it's a travesty. Go ahead.
What do you think the future, we're starting to hear about this fusion advancements. Do you think that's anything that's in our near future?
I have not researched that enough. I've always been more interested in those breeder reactors. There are other technologies that are coming forward. I really can't comment on the fusion. It seems always kind of space age, and they always say that it's so far in the future. But there's other things they can do. There's the new supercritical plants. They've got both the nuclear and the coal plants have got these facilities where they hold the water, the steam, in these super high pressure chambers, and they crank up the heat, you know, to probably, you know, 500-600 Fahrenheit, and they can hold it in that and release it in a timed fashion, and they get a lot more bang for the buck in terms of the amount of fuel. Like, they're doubling the amount of fuel with that technology. And some of those breeder reactors, the ones that, it's sort of like a Pong thing, because the byproduct of one reactor is plutonium, and it is used in the other reactor, and its byproduct is uranium-235. It's not a perpetual motion machine, But you can, if you set up these two reactors side by side, you can get a lot more bang for the buck out of the uranium ore. They canceled that because the price of uranium fell so much. But there's a lot they could be doing with those technologies. The tragedy is we're pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into research and development and building solar and biofuels and wind. The tragedy is that money could have been shunted and should be shunted towards the real technologies that work, like nuclear and coal and large dam hydro, things like that. We're being saddled with this expensive intermittent electricity. It's going to completely undermine the competitiveness of the American economy.
Well, I think nuclear has gotten such a bad rap in the last 20 or 30 years. I doubt if we're ever going to see a new nuclear plant being built in this country. There's just too much resistance to it.
Well, it's going to take a political revolution. But, yeah, I'm confident because I'm really liking the 118th Congress. I posted an article about that on Canada Free Press. It was on their cover. Over 80% of this Congress are climate science rejectors. They're doubters. I don't like to call them deniers, but these are people who are seeing through it. They are 80% of them. So there's a real collision happening, and it's going to impact not just coal and oil, but also nuclear. Like a really rethink of this. We have to, not just Americans, but Americans, Australians, Canadians have to rethink energy policy without the environmentalists in the room. We have to rethink fuel policy without the climate alarmists in the room. They must be purged from the room. We're going to have this conversation about how we're going to make electricity and how we're going to fire up our vehicles without these crackpots going on about carbon dioxide and sea levels in Vanunu. That is what has to happen.
And don't forget polar bears that we have lots of, but we're still talking about them.
There's too many polar bears.
Right, but we're still talking about them, which is amazing.
Ship them to Europe.
Yeah, the oceans turning to acid, that's one of my favorites.
I love that one.
Yeah.
Bleaching the coral that's actually white to start with.
Yeah. When they launched the climate change campaign, 1984, 1985, it was not as though it was something really weird at the time. You've already mentioned nuclear. Yeah, they created this huge phobia about radioactivity, about radio fallout. It was a wild exaggeration of the potential dangers. And they traveled the country lying about how much cancer was happening around nuclear power plants, and they mobilized this nuclear freeze movement, and they spiked the American nuclear industry. And that was being done at the same time. While that was happening, France was getting 90% of its electricity from nuclear. It's still 75%. Read an excellent sociology essay comparing Germany with France. And it's funny how one country can have this massive anti-nuclear movement, and across the border, there's zero anti-nuclear movement. That was interesting. But I think that, we're going to open all this up. This is all going to be opened up. I'm very confident that the momentum with this Congress, who knows? But they are going to really start rethinking a lot of the environmental restrictions that went down. Sorry, I got off topic there. When they launched the climate change campaign, it wasn't just global warming. They had already had a global cooling scare, and there was the nuclear fallout scare. There was a mercury poisoning scare. There was an acid rain scare. There was a desertification scare. They were all circulating in the mass media at the same time. So when there was a G7 meeting in London in 1984, Margaret Thatcher introduces climate change as an option. Her country has already committed herself to a coal phase-out due to just the labor strife with the coal industry. But they had committed themselves to a coal phase-out, and she is proposing climate change as an overarching rationale for both the petroleum and the coal phase-outs. And the assembled heads of government there, including Ronald Reagan, signed off on this. Although with Reagan and Bush Sr., they know that this isn't going to come to anything in the next 15, 20 years, and they were right. Like, it took a long time for this thing to really get pulled together. But after that G7 meeting, all the heads of government undertook to dispatch their environment ministers to write climate change synopsis threat assessments. And at the next G7 meeting in Bonn, they kicked off the climate crusade because they were all so convinced that we were, you know, at death's door in terms of a climate catastrophe. And within a few years, they had assembled the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and then a few years later, we have the Rio Summit and the United Nations Convention Framework Change. But it's those years, 84 to 92, were the critical years, where this movement went from just talk, just propaganda, into being an on-the-ground, tractioned movement that was receiving billions of dollars from several major governments. That was the transition that happened from 1984 to 1992. Prior to that, from 74 to 84, you have the beginnings of the petroleum phase-out. It starts with the Arab oil embargo, which terrifies Europe. They then launch campaigns to phase out petroleum in 1974. And they were campaigning to phase out petroleum for a decade before they rebranded the campaign climate change. And they fused it with the coal phase-out campaign. But it is really has everything to do. Like, you know, you have too many commentators are always trying to look around behind the elephant in the room. They think, well, this climate change campaign is a way to sort of change the whole society. No, it's a way to destroy your energy industry. That's doing enough damage. Don't worry about the other side effects of this. Go ahead.
Oh no! I was just thinking about how this whole thing started and how we've created celebrities or people with celebrity status now because they're these great climate change alarmists, and so much of it, if not all of it, is just bunk. And we can't seem to put enough people up front to prove that this information is fallacy.
Well, you just get called a heretic and then the game's over.
Yeah,
precisely. You are contradicting the authorities,
right?
And that is something that some people actually psychologically cannot do, it appears. I don't know how many...
They're still wearing masks.
How often have you had that argument? Like, you ever seen that one? She comes on CNN. I don't watch news, but I watch some of her clips on the Internet. S.E. Cup.
Yes.
She is one of the broadcasters on CNN, one of the vignette makers there. Several times she's broached the climate change issue. And she only has one argument. She just moves through the authorities. She goes, well, the EPA says it's a problem. And NASA says it's a problem, so it's a problem. Like the idea that the authorities could be wrong,
right.
Incomprehensible. Just incomprehensible.
Yeah, nobody does their own research. They just mimic everything that's been said in the past, and they just keep repeating it, and pretty soon people figure, well, it must be true.
Well, yeah.
Well, what was key was the capturing of scientific institutions in America.
Yeah.
In the 100th Congress. That was 1988 to 1990. George Bush Sr.'s president, both houses of Congress, solidly Democratic majority. They launched this thing called the U.S. Global Change Research Program. And its current budget is $5.5 billion at least. It's kind of hard to figure it out because it's an amalgamation of 13 different agencies, including the National Office of Oceans and Atmosphere and the EPA and NASA and the National Science Foundation. And each of these organizations have been commandeered to pump out climate propaganda. And that sort of umbrella group, the U.S. Global Change Research Program, puts out these national climate assessments periodically, and it's complete global warming bunk. But I'm looking at the budgets of the National Science Foundation, and I'm realizing what they call climate-themed funding is $2.5 billion. No, $1.5 billion And about half of that they give over to this other umbrella agency. NASA, as current budget, is getting $2.4 billion to address the climate crisis. And I'm moving around these
blocks. They say that all the time, address the climate crisis. The other part of it, too, is that if anybody wants to participate and have any type of funding options through the government, you have to have that lingo in your program. So if you're just... You have to incorporate that, otherwise you're kind of persona non grata.
Yeah, and it all starts with the assumption that there is climate change.
Right.
Nobody's
studying if it's real or not.
Right.
It's only about proving it. We have to take a really quick break.
Your definition. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, we got to take a really quick break, and we'll come right back. Talk about it some more.
All my friends, we're all misunderstood. They say we stand for nothing, and there's no way we ever could. Now we see everything that's going wrong with the world and those who lead it. We just feel like we don't have the means to rise above and beat it. So we keep waiting, waiting, waiting on the world to change. We keep on waiting, waiting, waiting on the world to change.
I can see by your eyes you must be lying. Thing I don't have a clue. Baby, you're crazy. If you think that you can fool me, because I've seen that movie too.
We have seen that movie, too, haven't we?
Yeah, we've seen that movie. I've seen that movie in reruns.
But once they did the international panel, the IPCC guys, once they showed up, then that seemed to be really a stark point.
That was 1988.
Was it really?
So that would have been 3 years after the 85 G7 summit when they... more or less consents that this was going to be a major crusade. It still took them a couple of years to assemble that. It is a crucial organization. It centralizes the scientists, mainly once again from the EU countries and from the English-speaking world, but they pull together what appears to be the authoritative statement. And in each instance, it's the leading government-funded science academies that are signing off on this. And that's what I was getting at. Right now the U.S. taxpayer is spending $10 billion a year to propagandize themselves with this climate science propaganda. The reason why so many people believe that climate science, the global warming hypothesis, that the catastrophic human-induced global warming hypothesis is true, is because NASA says it's true, it's because the NOAA says it's true, etc. It's because the National Science Foundation says it's true. And it was the capturing of these institutions with an absolute river of money that created that. And most people can't. The idea that if you would suggest to an SE cup that, a huge amount of government funding has absolutely corrupted climatology, it has absolutely corrupted atmospheric physics. And then those clowns would be janitors if they weren't preaching climate propaganda like that. And if you are not about to preach climate alarmist propaganda, you are not going to get any grant money. These people understand fully what they are doing, and they understand fully that it is a cultural war.
Yeah, I can't believe that. People look at the amount of money that's given to different agencies, different foundations, different states. I mean, all this federal money they could spread around, and they all scream about it, that it's influencing, whatever their subject is. But then when it comes to climate change, they spread this money around, and that's different. That doesn't have any effect on the outcome.
No, they're not marginalizing the scientists who disagree with them, which is how you usually do science. You have you have a robust debate. We stopped having robust debate quite a while ago.
But William's right. All the money that they give them, that influences, and nobody talks about that.
No, it is absolutely censored information. I'm just looking at the National Oceans and Atmosphere Agency, this year's budget. They've got a big budget, but within the budget, their climate budget is $256 million. That is their climate change propaganda budget. You know, and to real mortals, like $256 million, that is an absolutely enormous amount of money.
Sure it is.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want a howl, go to the NOAA. They are part of the Department of Commerce, actually. But if you go to their website, they've got a climate program grant funding opportunities. And there's right now probably 300-400 grants that are available between the $50,000 and $300,000 market. If you're a scientist, you can apply for them. They're just handing them out like candy.
Hmm.
And that has a dramatic influence. It's like, you know, it's like feeding time at the zoo sort of thing.
Wow. And we've
and
spoken.
Every one of those organizations, like NASA, is spending a lot more money doing it. But it's just the name of the game is you come up with scientific research that validates the climate alarmist model. They are not at all interested in someone coming up with things that poke holes in it.
Oh, they wouldn't get any money?
Zero. It's a propaganda machine. Now, the good news is huge numbers of Americans are aware of this. But the real bridge is now that you control Congress, the real contradiction is why doesn't the Republican-controlled Congress cut the funding off for this crap? Because it is so obviously nothing more than a scientific guise over top of an economic warfare stratagem, and your government is paying for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, they pay for
Congress.
I'm pretty sure the Senate and the President wouldn't sign any legislation of that kind.
Well, so. the Congress controls the money.
They don't control it to the end, though. All money.
They say, we are not paying for this. We are not paying for this.
Yeah, but all spending starts in the House. It just doesn't end there. They're not the start and stop. They're just the beginning. So, I mean, anything that has that in it, any cuts for that, I guarantee you the President isn't signing and the Senate isn't passing. Unfortunately.
Well, I don't know.
At this point.
It's a constitutional law argument, but it seems to give Congress control of the purse strings.
No, just the House. Congress is the House and the Senate.
House. I'm talking about the House of Representatives.
Yeah. So they
we're not paying for this, period.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, it's not as unilateral as it sounds.
What happens is people crumble. That's what happens.
Sure.
But I don't know. Though I'm looking at it, they have the authority to pull the plug on this crap.
Oh, they can definitely bring it to the attention of the American people and vote to cut the funding. But then when it goes to the Senate, you got the Fruit Loops over there that are going to say, we're not going to pass this.
The Senate can't generate funding for something that hasn't been approved by the House of Representatives.
Oh, true. They can't generate it,
but it's a negotiated bill.
The House of Representatives just sits there with their arms crossed and say, no, we're not funding this.
Yeah.
I know. Anyways, this is the constitutional argument. I could be wrong, but I think it's a political will thing. If you've got a majority in the House of Representatives, just absolutely refuse to pay for some of this stuff. It would cause a crisis. You're right about that.
Yeah. Well,
oh, yeah, and I think a lot of these politicians would really have to stand back and take a hard look at what they're voting to do and not do, because let's face it, they have to get reelected. And when the people realize that this money is going to these causes that are total bunk, and you have representatives and senators that are voting for it,
That's how you
change. You get rid of them, and you put people in there that understand it.
That people are not sure because the information isn't really there.
Oh, they've been browbeat with it for the last 30 years, and so it's got to be true. You know,
it's coming from their own government. They're using the immature.
Yeah.
They're using the symbolism of the National Science Academy and of NASA and things like that. And it's kind of hard to argue against it. Like, all SE Cup is doing is saying, NASA agrees with me and the National Science Academy agrees with me, and that's the end of the argument. Bye.
Yep.
Well, we've interviewed scientists who had really good data on the other side who were excommunicated from the scientific community for raising those issues and had their funding cut. I can't remember his name, but he was a professor at UCLA and wound up crossways with these guys. And the retribution is swift and dire.
It is true, and I could probably cull from my memories 40 or 50 stories like that. There was a book called The Deniers, bad title, but it was a profiling about a dozen leading academics. Some of them, the ones who speak openly are the ones who are about to retire. Quite often they say things like, I wouldn't dare say this if I wasn't about to retire.
Right.
But, you know, there was the former head of the Italian National Science Foundation, named Zinni, outspoken critic of the catastrophic global warming hypothesis, as are, like, you know, the list of, like, just the most high-profile scientists you can imagine. Like, one of the excellent book written by Dr. Ian Palmer of Australia called Heaven and Earth, best book I've read on climate change, and he's twice won the Australia's top science award, and he is a geologist, and he is someone who just rakes the theory over the coals. And there literally are dozens of just very high-profile scientists who you are never going to hear from in the mainstream media. And more often than not, these guys are so close to retirement or so deeply tenured or so well respected that they can get away with it. But the up and coming young bucks who are all working on 1-year contracts, you know, Joe scientist ain't paid to think down there. You better believe it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once we put so much money in it, you look at just little things. I look at little things that happen just in our local communities. You guys probably have that up there too, where, you know, they're going to do a project. They have to somehow tie it to the climate thing. Otherwise, there's no funding. Do you have that same problem in Canada?
Yeah, I wonder how much of that goes on. Oh, yeah. I've been doing research about this U.S. Global change budget, because a lot of these bureaucracies are notorious for doing that. Like, for one thing, they're always creating a new umbrella bureaucracy to oversee what all these other bureaucracies are doing. And the other bureaucracies under the umbrella are each committing some of their resources to the project, but it's not entirely clear whether they're actually changing what they were originally planning to do, or are they just changing the names of what they're doing. That goes on a lot. For better or for worse. But, yeah, it's, in terms of academic funding, I've heard that story multiple times, that try to incorporate climate change into whatever your grant proposal is, if you want them to, you want anyone to notice it. That's sort of the quasi, you know, sort of totalitarian world we're getting into now. And that's how important this energy transition is to the people who are pushing the energy transition. This is an existential threat to them. If we do not phase out fossil fuels, they believe that, you know, certainly the Europeans believe that Europe is actually doomed. If we remain locked into a fossil fuel-driven plan for the next 2 centuries, Europe will become an economic basket case. It will become an economic backwater. It will be a tourist trap and nothing else.
And why do they think that?
Because they are spending $500 billion a year. They are hemorrhaging huge amounts of money, and they're giving it to their enemies, the Americans, the Russians, the Arabs. This can't go on forever. They have to build their way into energy independence. And even then, if the rest of the world, particularly the Anglosphere, Canada, Australia, and the USA, if they remain on fossil fuel track, they will continue to boom and expand. And they will ultimately just dwarf and actually consume through migration a lot of the European countries. So they view themselves on a downbound train as long as they're trapped in a fossil fuel economy. And they're also, there's a deep, almost religious environmentalism that you get in Europe that you do not get anywhere else. Google the phrase. Go ahead.
Do you see any of the EU leaders kind of looking the other way or looking away from this whole climate nonsense and trying to get back or is this kind of set in stone? This is their path, and they're not going to deviate.
The latter is true, because they are not operating against the interests of their economic elites by any means.
Right.
An article I wrote called "The Rise of the Climate Oligarchs."
Hang on to that thought, and we're going to come back. We're going to talk to you on the flip side for the next hour. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill?
Well, our sponsor is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And they're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. They have a great inventory right now. Go by and see them. If you're looking for anything from a mower to a tractor, they've probably got it in stock. Attachments, they have a fully staffed service department. If you need something worked on, go up and talk to them. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Nice. All right. Speeding back to our guest, William Alter Kay. I guess I should let people know.
I just wanted to say
yes?
that John Deere is an excellent American company, and they are very popular up in Saskatchewan. You see John Deere tractors quite a bit.
Home.
Nothing yeah. runs like a deer.
That's right. Yeah, you know, it's funny. You come out to the West Coast, and there's all these different brands of tractors. And, you know, most of your big farms run John Deere, but huge market in a lot of these what I would consider aftermarket tractors. But you go into the Midwest and you buy a tractor, and if it's not green, you better sell your property and move, because they own
just
the Midwest.
Shameful.
Yeah, you're shaming.
They got competition out here for sure, but yeah, there is tremendous brand loyalty to
here.
The people that do buy them, man, yeah, they're fighting words.
It's yep. criticized. Yep. Right, so. Great company.
Oh, so.
Okay, let's get back.
Yes. So, Mr. K, we, you know, it seems like we're just hopelessly mired in this, like,
I am hopeful.
No, but I mean, it feels like, right? It feels like it's surrounding everybody, and they feel like there's no, yes, you can get smart about it. You can realize that this is all part of a big, basically kind of a big scam. But do you see, where do you see it going? You see us getting out of the trap?
I see a hammer called the EU crashing against an anvil called the U.S. Republican Party.
Oh.
The whole objective of this exercise is to shut down America's coal and oil industry. And the effort to do that is increasingly reaching resistance. Look at this Congress. I'm guessing 80% of them are already on record as saying they don't even believe the climate science. So they're certainly not going to put up with a whole series of policies and regulations that are going to continue to penalize fossil fuels in the name of this bogus climate science. I think things are coming to a climax here.
Yeah.
It's important to both sides, but I think there's sort of a falling away from the scales from people's eyes. I think more and more people, because they've been grinding on about this climate for so long. There's a lot of climate fatigue. When they do studies of what do Americans care about politically, climate is right at the bottom. Like in the real world of the issues that people are dealing with, like what the planet's going to look like 200 years from now is not an issue. And I came across that trove. You know, the Center for the American Progress is just sort of an adjunct of the U.S. Democratic Party. And in 2017, they thought they were going to embarrass the Republicans by exposing all the climate deniers in Congress. But when they finished doing it, and all they wanted proof of being a climate denier, and they had quite a list of all the things. If you thought the climate was unsettled, if you thought the climate science was unsettled, if you thought there really wasn't a consensus, you were a denier. If you said words like the climate has always been changing, you were branded as a denier. If you didn't think that a 1 degree increase in temperature was a big catastrophe, you're a climate denier. And at the end of the day, they realized there were over 180 Republicans in Congress that were deniers, and that shocked them. They were hoping to find a couple of dozen old retiring curmudgeons, right? But no, they realized that a huge portion of it. And their subsequent studies, they tried to shrink it and make it look smaller so there wasn't as many deniers. And they're clearly not counting them all. So now we're in the 118th. It's probably in excess of 80%. There's been a huge surge in them. And they're even more outspoken. And that's why the Center for American Progress website is such a treasure trove, because they've got video after video. And it's not the people you think. It's people like Liz Cheney coming right out on video saying climate science is junk science. It cuts a real broad spectrum, like Mitch McConnell and Ted Cruz, et cetera. A huge spectrum of the Republican Party are on video, on audio, debunking the science.
Yeah, that seems.
Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, that I didn't realize that with Liz Cheney, but she was from Wyoming, so couldn't have been too crazy at one point.
That was fairly recent. Like, the point is that it's not a minority viewpoint within the Republican Party. Republican Party members don't even know the extent to which it's a prevailing point of view, because some of these video clips. Like Bob Good, I don't think he's from Georgia, but he's just standing there shouting, saying, climate change is a hoax. This is fake news. I mean, he's not pulling any punches at all. And I don't think there's even some articles about, you know, Kevin McCarthy, because he comes from, his jurisdiction includes part of Kern County, which is oil patch.
Yep.
And there's some good articles with Kevin McCarthy really going after Obama, saying that he is manipulating the climate agenda. And he's to refuse to deal with the water issues in California. And he's manipulating the climate agenda to undermine California's petroleum industry. That's from Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah, that's not surprising. I mean, he comes from farm country.
Yeah,
Kern. They say if Kern County was an independent state of the Union, it would be the fourth largest oil producer in America. They must have some serious oil down there.
Oh, yeah, California is sitting on a huge, huge reserve. I think one of the biggest in the world. But I think another factor facing this Congress is, not only are there a lot of skeptics in the Congress, but their constituents, I think, are getting pretty fed up with the whole thing. It's costing them money.
Mm-hmm.
Inflation's out of control. They're looking at all these policies that have led to, you know, $9 for a dozen eggs. And they're looking for answers, and they're looking for action. And I think they're going to have to produce it. And with this whole climate change thing, it's killing so many industries, particularly in California. I mean, you can't drill offshore. You can't, like in McCarthy's district, full of oil wells. There's just all kinds of restrictions. They've shut down pipelines. People are paying $5 a gallon for gas. I mean, it's got to come to a head, and I think the legislatures are getting pressured to make a change. And I think you're right. I think this Congress has a golden opportunity to move a lot of this stuff forward and get rid of a lot.
The House does. The Senate has no interest.
Yeah, the Senate is going to be a tough nut because I mean they're still well entrenched over there, and it's going to be hard. But I think if we can show an interest in the House to make these changes in 2024, you might see the Senate flip, and then you're going to see some big changes.
Yeah.
Well, it would be a partial victory if the climate skeptics, who are the majority now, certainly of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, if they would start having powwows, if they would start making speeches. I don't think they're aware of their own strength in numbers. That Center for American Progress, they take you to an Excel spreadsheet, and it's got 300 videos and audios of U.S. Republican Congress people denouncing climate science. I keep thinking, what a bunch of fools for even posting this, because they started out trying to embarrass the Republicans, and then they became stunned by how many of them never bought into this climate crap in the first place. But yeah, it's a great resource. So I think, you know, part one is, you know, be more outspoken about what you think about climate science, and try to get coherent about what is causing this. And that gets back to this whole European thing. Because if all we're going to do is say it's the Chinese communists are somehow manipulating, you know, all of these business agents and all of these politicians are somehow puppetry controlled by them, it is not politically plausible.
Well, they spread a lot of money out with folks. There's a lot of political pressure from Chinese money in this country. I mean, I don't
believe
discount
so.
That.
Yes. This is true. It's like this. I watched a documentary a while ago, 90-minute one, and it was following the American-Israel Political Action Committee. It's a really powerful political action committee. And the creators of the documentary, they're following these sort of wealthy Jewish families around, and they whip up this whole conspiracy theory that basically, you know, you can make it look like these guys are actually controlling the American government. Right. And what they're losing in that kind of a documentary is perspective of how crowded a room that is. Israel is not the only country in the world trying to influence the American government. China is not the only country in the world trying to influence the American government. Saudi Arabia and Taiwan and around the world, everyone is trying to influence the American government. So it's a really crowded room. If you just focus on one group, yeah, you can make them into this diabolical monster that's controlling it. That's sort of what I do with the EU. But when you really look at how institutionally integrated the American government is through NATO and through the OECD in particular and through G7 and a lot of these other institutions, the American government, like the ministerial conferences and the heads of state conferences, there is an integration going on there that does not exist with any other collection of governments. And the EU is not some little country. The EU has a population of 450 million. A lot of those are rich countries, you know, Germany, Sweden, that. They're not, this isn't some backwater. They exert a lot of influence. And as I have pointed out in some other writings, there's about 8 strategic corporations in Europe that dominate America's publishing industry, dominate America's music industry, advertising industry, etc. And no other country or collection of countries exerts that kind of influence on American culture or owns that extent of cultural assets within America. It's, you know, China does not own 1% of the book publishing and movie production and music industries that these European countries do.
Well, Germany, though, is the main player there. I mean, they're the ones that contribute the most money, aren't they?
They're the richest country. Germany has a population of around 88 to 90 million. It's smaller than the state of Montana. They're certainly the richest country in the world, and they're the ones that are, not in the world, but in Europe, and they are definitely the main cog. In terms of climate fanaticism, no, the Swedes are way ahead of them on that front.
Right.
The Swedes imposed a carbon tax 30 years ago.
Did they really?
They had a carbon. It was in 1988, the same year the IPC was formed, so that is 24 years ago.
Wow.
They already had a carbon tax. They are completely carbon neutral. They are determined to make all of their products carbon neutral so they can create tariff barriers all around the European Union so that they all have to buy these products.
And what's Sweden's population?
10 million.
Yeah.
Don't ask how many men and women, because they also no longer see that distinction.
Yeah.
They're way ahead on that one, too.
But, you know, when you're running an economy for 10 million people, it's a whole lot different than running an economy for 300 million people. There's things they can do that, you know, these bigger nations just can't implement. You can't do it.
I saw a report from a Swedish academic, and he made a joke saying Sweden has but one export, and we have one trading partner. We export our unemployment to America.
Isn't that sad?
Thanks for
Swedish
that.
National economic strategy.
Yeah.
And I do verily believe it would take forensic accountants to figure it out, but they have various ways in which they're subsidizing a lot of their production. They're a manufacturing company like IKEA and Volvo and Electrolux. It's basically a manufacturing country. But a lot of the lumber and iron is coming through sort of state-owned enterprises, and I think they're dumping a lot of stuff in the American market. But what they are absolutely devoted to is the idea of completely emissions-free metal manufactured products. The metal that they are producing is carbon free.
Gosh, to live in a world filled with IKEA furniture.
The IKEA furniture and driving a Volvo.
Warm and lustrous.
All electric.
Yeah, electric Volvo.
Oh, my
God. Put your Prius to shame.
Well, so, you know, just as a nod to the, you know, the propaganda. I thought I'd play some a little bit of propaganda music so you had something to hum along with next time you heard your little thing here. So here you go. I am the earth.
I am the sunset sky.
I thought that'd be like a little pick-me-up after the I Am the Earth song. take that vomit out of the back of your throat.
The music is politics. Music is propaganda. A lot of music is.
It is, isn't it?
All kinds of political themes.
Yeah,
okay, that is a great segue into this topic. Because,
yes.
I mean, who has ever heard of the Bolor family?
The what family?
The Bolors.
How do you spell it?
B-O-L-L-O-R-E, the Bolors.
Huh.
You must have heard of them.
Okay, the hard pass.
Vincent Bolor and Yannick Bolor. Anyways, they're a French oligarchic family, and they own a corporation called Vivendi. It's gone through many names over the years. It's been a structured corporation now since 1822, so it's now in 201st year. And amongst other things, the Bolor family manufactures lithium metal polymer batteries for them. The heavy storage for those standalone massive storage units. They've got a key patent on those. They also manufacture electric buses. A few people do that. They have an electric mini car they manufacture. This is all in France, and they run the country's largest car sharing service for electric cars. They're deeply vested in that. But what people also don't know about his family is they own the Universal Music Group.
Oh.
They have a controlling interest of that company. Universal Music Group has 105 labels now. Capitol Records, Island Records, Decca, Def Jam, Deutsche Grammophon, Polydor, Motown, Republic. They have 1,000 recording artists. You go to their Wikipedia page and you look at, who doesn't work for these guys? They control, last year they had 26% of global sales of physical musical products and 34% of global sales of all digital musical products. And their market share in the U.S. is a lot larger than that. Over half of all the music purchased in America is coming from this company.
Aren't they big in publishing as well?
No, that's another subsidiary. The same family owns, it's called Hachette Livre.
Okay.
And it is, I think, the world's third largest book publishing company. That's the same family owns that.
Wow.
But there's another family in Germany called the Mon family, and they have a corporation called Bertelsmann. And Bertelsmann, they just lost a big lawsuit. They tried to buy Simon & Schuster, and that would have been it. The big three would have controlled 100% of the American book publishing industry. But as it is right now, Bertelsmann, they put out 15,000 new titles every year in the English language. When you go into a Barnes & Noble like that, over half the books are coming from one company. And this other company that's owned by Belor and another company called Holdspring together, over 80% of the market. And if you're talking about any publishing dealing with climate and climate science, think in terms of 90-95% of all publishing, scientific or otherwise, on that topic, is coming out of three or four strategic corporations. And that we don't really have a lot of them over here, strategic corporations, but you see them in Europe. A lot of these companies have a history of either being state-owned or quasi-state-owned. They operate hand in glove with their governments to a degree that we really don't see here. And online, there's a report that was put out by Friends of Science that I wrote, and it just profiles eight of these leading European multinationals that are mass media companies. A lot of them are in the advertising world as well. They dominate American advertising as well. And they are all strategic companies. They are all operating in close conjunction with either the French, German, or Swedish governments. And they dominate American culture right now. No two ways about it. And there's a lot of major European multinationals that buy a lot of advertising space in America. And this is being done. I'm increasingly seeing it. They are doing this at a colluded way, such that they can bring more pressure to bear on network television and groups like that. They're using their advertising clout in a very effective political way. And there's a lot of companies. There's a group called the World Council on Sustainable Development, and it has 200 of the world's largest multinationals, and the CEOs of each one of those companies agree to meet once a year. And I checked that list, and there were 97 European companies on there, and a lot of them were like Michelin Tires and Nestle's Food. These are major advertising buyers. And if you add up all that, and you keep in mind that Europe also dominates the advertising industry, you realize that these groups are spending tens of billions of dollars in America in terms of ad purchases and ad manufacturing. And that is why you see these network TV stations are also pro-climate. That's what I believe. I believe there's huge amounts of money coming in a very coordinated fashion from these European companies into the American mass media system.
Are they promoting the whole woke agenda as well? Because, I mean,
yes.
I see so much of that on television now.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
To them, it's all the same thing. It's a fertility suppression campaign. They are also devout environmentalists. They do believe the world is overpopulated. Keep in mind, they have a lot of allies in America. It isn't as though this is entirely this alien thing coming in. They have a profound fifth column of support in America. But yeah, this is all, they are, the climate agenda, it's almost impossible to, unravel it from the environmental movement, but it is different. The climate agenda is a movement of governments aimed at phasing out oil and coal. It is that. Whereas the environmental movement is a much broader thing that has, hundreds of thousands of little organizations that often don't even agree with one another and often are even thwarting the climate agenda. So it's two different things, but they do really come together. And you will find it in Europe, the Green parties are frequently coalition government members, and parties like that move the whole spectrum so much further to the Green to understand Europe. I don't like to use terms left and right because these are really not being used in a historically coherent fashion anymore. But definitely, the whole agenda regarding LGBT rights and transgenderism and multiculturalism, what have you. Yeah, they're big on that.
Yeah, you'd think that, if you watch much television advertising, you would think that 75% of the American population is either gay or trans, because, I mean, it's on every commercial. And I always kind of cringe when I see that, because it's not a true representation of what our society looks like.
No, it's a goal. Like they have a very dim view of Americans. A lot of Americans have a very dim view of Americans. They really want a very low birth rate, a low fertility birth rate. There's also a deeply, deeply racist thing going on here. It has always been the fantasy of European enemies of America that the Achilles heel of America would be racial conflict, black versus white, Hispanic versus white. And if you really look at their cultural agenda, they are systematically fanning racial animosity in America. It looks like they're doing the other, but they're not. I think part of the end game for them is to really start playing that card. And I can establish beyond a shadow of a doubt that rap music was primarily a project of, once again, sort of this European cultural imperialist community. And that rap music, I don't even call it music, it's just crap. And if you listen to it, it is just someone spewing racist, sexist propaganda.
Yeah, it is. It is. That's an interesting take, though. I never thought of it that way. Yeah,
well, I just despise that guy. It's propaganda. And, talk about a civics lesson. I mean, they're encouraging the absolutely worst kind of behavior. The lyrics of rap, it's predatory, pimping and hard drug dealing. You're making heroes out of these kind of people.
Yeah.
And that rap music doesn't come from the street. It comes from these big record companies.
Yeah.
Rap music, there was a time when Philips Electric in Holland owned a bunch of record companies. They were the ones, I can't remember the label, but it really kicked off rap music, and they sold that to Bertelsmann, which is now the book publishing people. They used to have a huge music division, but it was under their watch that several of these really hardcore rap bands started to develop. They were all being promoted by Bertelsmann, which is a strategic German company, and they built this thing up. If you look at who were the real rap stars over the history of rap, they were always assigned on to either the Philips or BMG, and that later got transferred to another European multinational. Like those guys are all puppets.
Yeah, they don't even realize who they're working for.
No, they don't. And I just appalled by this crap. People like Kanye West. I like musicians. I'm old school. I like musicians that can play a musical instrument. They can sing, they can dance, they can do anything. I mean, this guy's a musician. I don't see any talent whatsoever.
No.
He just seems like a doorknob on the stage. that's so much of rap music. Like, where exactly is none of these guys play musical instruments.
Right.
Their lyrics sound like they're written by a 10-year-old.
Yeah. But they can move and grab their crotch and, get the crowd worked up, and that sells tickets.
And if you listen to the lyrics, it's just this, they're using the N-word all the time.
Oh, yeah.
They're using the B-word all the time. So they're just polluting the cultural atmosphere with this crap. So this is a very regressive influence on American society. It's a very regressive influence on the African-American culture. I mean, that is the last thing you want them to emulate.
Yeah.
You would think.
Well, it's not benefiting society any. That's for sure. I was going to point out to people that on July 10th of last year, and I had that listed on the page for today, but on the web. We have linked your show then, Climate Change and European Cultural Imperialism, and we went into a lot more detail in that show, and it's really worth listening to if people are unaware of that connection with Europe, because it has become like China versus us, Russia versus us and China and Ukraine and blah blah blah.
It's not to say that China is suddenly your ally, and I think there's a real animosity there. But it is just, it's like when after Pearl Harbor, America did not go attack Brazil. I mean, America went to war with the people who did it, Japan. If you look at the climate change campaign, it is fairly obviously orchestrated out of Europe, not that they don't have a lot of allies over here. And not that they, China, as we pointed out, has certainly capitalized on it. And they've become a major player in the climate industrial complex. But this is not their baby. No, this thing definitely came out of Europe.
But it's working for them nonetheless. I mean, what a great deal. Yes. If you can get your enemies to destroy themselves, you could win a lot faster.
Yeah, I know, but I'm not going to sort of dwell on this too much. They simply are not the people who are driving this. They don't have 1% of the cultural influence that the Europeans are currently exerting on America. The Chinese do not have 1% of that.
No, not especially
now. When you think environmentalism, you don't think, Shanghai.
Yeah, no.
You think Sweden.
And those guys, it's the strangest part is it's not working out for them, and yet they don't seem to be reversing course at all.
I don't think they've got any choice. They are doomed if the world stays on a fossil fuel track. I mean, they have bet the farm on this. All of the major European car manufacturers, Volkswagen, BMW, Mercedes, Renault, they have all bet the farm on this. They have built battery manufacturing facilities. They have rejigged their main factories. They are committed irrevocably to electromobility. They've bet the farm. To turn this around now, that can't happen. They passed the point of no return. They've made such an investment in biofuels. They've made such an investment in wind power. I don't see them, this whole generation of government leaders and business leaders that did this, for them now to say this was all a giant mistake. I cannot imagine this happening. No, this has to come crashing down old school. I don't know where it goes.
Well,
obvious that Europe.
The whole battery thing, we were talking at the break, as more and more people embrace this battery technology in vehicles, and look at California, they want everything to go battery by 2035. That's going to put a lot of pressure on battery manufacturers. And do we have the long-term resources to continue to develop and produce high volumes of batteries? I mean,
I don't know. I saw an article about, it was in California, they've got one of these giant battery parks. They look like trailer parks.
Yeah.
And the thing cost $550 million.
Oh!
And it's just an array of batteries. The amount of electricity you could make if you put that into coal or any other form of electricity, it's a joke. They're wasting money on that. But it's a good point. Like, I don't know how far in the future these people think, but you'd think there would be some major log jams and bottlenecks in getting supplies for that many batteries.
The resources.
But they're also great believers in recycling batteries, too. So
I don't know. I just look at the amount of resources required to make these batteries and the amount of energy required to make these batteries. And as the demand increases, the strain on these resources is going to increase. And I just don't see it.
Well, it just doesn't make sense. Every time you have like a big holiday, you have a big storm, anytime there's an event that takes people out of their normal everyday tracking, you see the jam up, right? You've got all these people at the battery charging thing, and it's just not functional. And again, maybe if we were in a different scenario, but we drive long miles, especially people who live in the rural parts of both of our countries, in Canada and in the U.S., you don't have a battery thing every 200 miles or whatever fool thing it is. It just isn't workable. Hey, so we have to take a quick break. And in deference to bad music, I thought I would play pretty much the worst climate song I've ever found. Oh, here he is. He's on.
See a temperature rising. What mighty glaciers we. I look at you now. See your oceans arising. While nations are lost in the deep. I don't know why nobody told you they stole and fooled you.
Yep. So the Beatles probably filing a lawsuit right now against the perpetrator of When Mighty Glaciers Weep.
That's a horrible song.
That's actually the worst version of it, too. If you go to YouTube, there's several versions of it. The guy was really proud of it. He got his friends to sing along with him. And, yeah. It's pretty bad, but that's what passes for propaganda in the climate world.
Well, if you go to that Universal Music Group's website, they have a section on there on climate change. They have one of the things that they are mobile. They quite openly say that music is culture and that they are in the culture business. They're not at all shy about the fact that they are using the UMG is using music to promote this. But back to what we were getting at about, you know, are there going to be enough batteries? How is this going to work?
Yeah.
Look at Los Angeles County. Look at all those cars. I mean, how is that all going to get powered up on batteries? It simply isn't going to work very well. If it works at all, and you're going to end up seeing a lot of disrupted transportation, and you're going to see a lot of brownouts and other problems. You're going to see sort of a third worldization of the California economy. That's what you're going to get. Because we've got to get back to square one here. This really is an economic warfare campaign. If you listen to the Mark Moranos and the Tucker Carlsons and the Alex Joneses, whenever they get onto climate, they start screaming, this is crazy. This is nuts. They're destroying America's oil industry. This is absolutely crazy. We're going to end up, you know, screwed. It's not crazy. Okay? It would be crazy if it was entirely domestic thing, like Americans just started running out of their houses screaming about carbon dioxide and saying that, you know, we've got to completely change our energy system.
Yeah.
That would be crazy. But that never happened. This was a systematic campaign starting at the top government level and promoted. It wasn't a mass uprising. This wasn't an act of mass hysteria. This is a political program. And it's the fact that our governments have been so hijacked by the Europeans and their allies within our countries that they're getting away with this. But this is not an accident, and this is not mass hysteria. So when you confront an issue like, well, how is this really going to work? This is going to, when you realize this is going to lead to major transportation and electrical disruption. This is going to really impoverish the people of America. Well, if this is an economic warfare campaign, that is what it is supposed to do. If this is a rational energy plan, it's ridiculous. It simply wouldn't happen. The American people would not abandon coal. They would not abandon the internal combustion engine if it was left up to them and it was truly a democracy. Something is being imposed on America. And it is going to be very bad news for America if they destroy the coal and oil industries. You're going to start looking like Somalia or Honduras. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I don't think a lot of people realize that, much like the lumber industry, when you shut down the big mills you don't produce that product anymore, you can't just go back in, turn the lights on, start producing lumber again. Same thing with the coal industry. You shut those coal plants down.
The infrastructure is
Is screwed. I mean, it's going to take a long time
to get
them back.
And the human skills.
Yes.
You lose the human skills of lumberjacks and things like that in a generation. It's not easy to get that back. You need people to train people consecutively.
Right.
And so, yeah, you do devastating harm to the economy when you kill an industry like that.
Yep.
And it's happening now.
Well, you look at how that has morphed over time, and this other thing will do the same deal. You know, back when they had the Spotted Owl and the Earth First Movement and all that stuff, all kind of happened around the same time, all pointed at destroying the timber industry and saving trees and blah, blah, blah. Well, when they did that, not only did the mills go away, but you took our people out of the forest. So they weren't in the forest. Now the forests are overgrowing. Well, what do you hear about now in the West? Nothing but unending fires.
Yeah, there's far too much fuel out there.
And there's nobody out there.
I'm a great believer in clearing these forests.
Well, the timber companies were out there.
Converting them into agricultural land. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, what is a tree for?
Yeah.
Well, the war in the woods that happened in the Pacific Northwest, definitely in Canada, profoundly shrank the size of that industry. It was based on just absolute lies. I mean, just get one lie after the other. For one thing, that spotted owl was being rendered extinct by another owl called the barn owl. The barn owls were eating the little spotted owls, and there's not a lot humanity could really do about this, unless we're really in the business of sort of intervening to protect their species that are endangered that way. You know, 99.99% of all the species that ever existed on Earth have gone extinct, and they didn't get killed by industry. They got extinct by Mother Nature.
Right. And the knee-jerk reaction is to jump in and save them, you know. And
save the spot from the barn owl.
Yeah, exactly.
what's the barn owl supposed to eat? It's a pretext. It's a phony pretext, just like climate change. You know, at some levels in the inner sanctums, they know these stories are bogus. There's a priceless book by Alston Chase called In a Dark Wood, and it's about the campaign to destroy Seattle, Washington State's, and then Oregon's forest industries. And someone smuggled a tape recorder into an Environmental Grant Makers Association meeting. And one of the alpha males in the room made this comment: "The problem is not that Joe Sixpack doesn't know what's going on. The problem is that Joe Sixpack does know what's going on. He's losing his job, and he's not getting it back." And that the same is going to apply to the oil patch, the coal industry. Joe Sixpack knows what's going on, but he's just powerless to do anything about it.
Right. Right.
Yes. And that you can't, you don't roll back from a lot of that right away. You just don't.
It's far from terminal. I mean, right now, I think it's reversible.
It is. It's always reversible. It just takes time.
Yeah. Well, I said, I'm very optimistic. I think things are really coming to a crescendo. I think the scales are falling from people's eyes, and they're starting to see this climate campaign as something that's really sinister. Like, keep in mind, we all agree. This whole climate science is BS. It's a flimsy hypothesis. It's a B-movie plot. It's a scare plot. It's all it is. But once you acknowledge that this is a deliberate lie, then suddenly the people that are perpetrating this become a whole lot more insidious. Like, these people really are trying to destroy America's economy. and they're having boardroom meetings where they calculate various improved strategies for doing this. Your attitude towards the people who are doing this, this is no longer just a bunch of flaky professors riding a gravy train. No, these are people who are calculating to undermine the critical infrastructure of the American economy. That is what is going on here.
Well, you've got the academia pumping all these kids full of crap, and now they've come to the age of having to go out and get a job and support themselves, and all they've been taught is all this propaganda. So, you know, what's left for them to do but basically, you know, revolt and try to push this agenda on everybody else, because they don't know any different.
You're talking about the sort of the young eco-activist types.
Yes.
Increasingly, I see them. This is debatable. I see them as entirely mercenary. I don't think the climate movement has any street creds left at all. And that is debatable. There's some stuff from George Mason University's climate change communication department, and they're claiming there's 8 million Americans willing to participate in civil disobedience for the climate. I don't think so.
Nah, I don't think so either.
When Greta called her last rally in Sweden, 15 kids showed up.
No kidding?
Really? Oh, that's encouraging.
They've got no street kids. It's like AOC now. She's getting heckled everywhere she goes.
Well, she's running out of time.
They're increasingly looking like political actresses. You know, they're losing it. And I don't think this whole climate campaign is going to mobilize any volunteerism. To the extent to which you see people sitting down on the road, they're going to be paid to sit there. And that becomes an expensive proposition. Although there's some of these institutes like Climate Works Foundation and the Energy Works Foundation, these are groups that have budgets in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's possible that you want to see a mercenary operation, they can deliver that. You know, they're going to get thousands of people and pay them to sit on the road. But it's going to be all rent-a-mob. I recall I arrived on the West Coast just after the end of the great wars in the forest. I wouldn't have participated anyways. But having spoken to a lot of people who did participate, back in the day they did have street cred. You know, it was only, you know, a few dozen professional organizers could mobilize a couple of hundred people, you know, often with a lot of sort of like freebies and free lunches and what have you. But that, those days are gone. I believe that they have just sort of, they've used up whatever they've had in terms of your real popular sentiment.
And how long can you follow Al Gore's, you know, handbook, and everything in it has not happened, you know. So,
it's that whole Al Gore guy. They don't exactly inspire, you know, a self-sacrificing sort of martyr for the cause.
But the idea that we're done in 10 years, and then the 10 years passes, and then 10 years goes by, and then more 10 years, and you know, none of their things have worked out the way they have said.
Yeah, they're decades of false prophecies.
Yeah.
Except for that latest guy.
What collusion with the media. Go ahead.
Did you follow that? I can't think of his name. The latest guy who was wrong about everything, and he somehow...
Oh, Paul Ehrlich?
Yeah, is that who it was? And he became like a big... all of a sudden he was back on, I think it was 60 Minutes or something.
Yeah, this is Paul Ehrlich. He's the guy that wrote The Population Bomb.
Yeah.
Rewrote it. He plagiarized it in 1968, sold millions of copies. Yeah, we were all going to starve to death in the 70s. And then every time they ask him, he just bumps it ahead 10, 15 years, somehow claims that it's actually happening when it isn't. And they still make a hero out of this guy. He's clearly been absolutely wrong at every prediction since 1968, for 54 years of wrong predictions, and he still gets an hour on CBS. And he's the ultimate population control fanatic. He was the guy who explicitly was advocating pouring sterilants into urban water supplies to prevent women from having kids. Like, he's an over-the-top population control fanatic, and that is why they keep resurrecting that dinosaur.
Wow.
The grifter of all grifters.
Well, we made millions off that population bomb because it was just hyped to the moon. I remember that.
Well, when we did that show with you about population control. That was June 24th of 2018. It's all on the page for today. If people want to go look at that, we're actually broadcasting live on January 15th, 2023, and you can find it at wethepeopleradio.us. I would go back and listen to that show if you still have some concern about the population thing, because I think that was pretty well...
Yeah, it was. That was a great show.
Pretty well peeled apart, and you gave us a whole bunch of resources for that. So we have basically hit the end of the road here with you. William,
yeah.
We'll chat soon, because we have a lot to talk about with all this kind of stuff, and we appreciate all your good research.
My pleasure.
Yeah,
thanks,
we'll have
a
million.
All right, stay warm up there. See you guys next week.
For good.